Well, as we continue our discussion of 19th century philosophy, we're going to add now a third stream or a third road that flows out of Hume and Kant, a different way of reacting to them. We have looked at the rationalist response in Hegel. We've looked at the non-cognitivist responses of voluntarism, romanticism, subjective individualism, and finally nihilism. Both of those have proven to be a very sad dead end in various ways. You don't really get the truth, and in the end you end up with a broken human nature, and there are no truths. In fact, for Nietzsche, the truth isn't even important anymore. Is that what Western culture has come to? Well, the reason why now in the late 20th century this may have surprised you, that 19th century philosophy had these sorts of problems, is because we are in, if you will, the more Anglo-American side of Western culture and its development. And what I'm going to be putting on the board now is the third response to Hume and Kant is something that you'll identify with a great deal more, and it's what I'll call the road of secularism. Board, let me tell you that earlier when I was illustrating the three responses to Hume and Kant, what I am now calling secularism, I labeled phenomenalism. Phenomenalism. The reason why I did that is because the philosophers we're now going to be looking at, they denied the phenomenal-noumenal distinction of Kant. There is no thing in itself or ultimate reality beyond the appearances to our senses. And the reason why I have diagrammed things in the particular physical configuration you see here on the board is that I want you to see that secularism and rationalism have that in common, that there is no thing in itself. Hegel denied the thing in itself. And he said, through the process of history, ultimate reality is manifesting itself. The secularists that we're now going to study, they too deny the idea that there's a thing in itself. And they too have what amounts to a process view of history. Where does that come to? Classic expression, Darwinian evolution. And so there's an interesting parallel here. Even though the secularists despised the rational theorizing of Hegel, found it ridiculous, full of pomp and circumstance, saying nothing. On the other side of Hegel, you have the non-cognitivists. They agree with Hegel that we can be in touch with ultimate reality. Hegel says you do it through your reasoning process. The non-cognitivists don't agree with that. It's not through reasoning that we're in touch with reality, but through blind irrational will, our emotions, our commitments, or ultimately our will to power. Maybe I'm just too tired here and I think too highly of this, but I think if you master this diagram, you'll understand the 19th century. The non-cognitivist route, the rationalist route, and now we're going to begin talking about secularism, where metaphysics is replaced by the philosophy of history, by sociology, and by psychology. Where metaphysics is replaced by the philosophy of history, sociology, and psychology. And a note on psychology, we could have an entire week of lectures just on the development of psychology and its crucial place and function in the development of modern culture. You know, the study of Freud and thereafter. But I'm a philosopher, not a psychologist, and we don't have a whole lot of time, as you know. So all I am going to tell you is remember that though psychology is one of these things replacing metaphysics, I'm not going to say a whole lot more about that. But it's a huge domain. Just think about all of the effects on movies, on the way people write, on the way they think of themselves, on the court system, on and on and on, of the development of psychology. Well, that's part of the secularist route of the 19th century. Metaphysics replaced by the philosophy of history, by sociology and psychology. If you will, the secularism of which I'm speaking amounts to scientism and social reform. Scientism and social reform. There were, in the 19th century, some developments that practically ignored Kant in his psychologizing of reason and science. Developments that didn't pay attention to how Kant had mitigated confidence in reason and science by psychologizing it, and didn't answer his critical challenge. And I mean critical here both in the mundane sense, but also in the technical sense. His is the philosophy of criticism. There were developments in the 19th century that practically ignored Kant's psychologizing of reason and science, didn't answer his critical challenge, but more or less continued in a direct and naive fashion the Enlightenment's confident attitude toward reason. Not pure reason, as Kant tried to criticize it in his Critique of Pure Reason, but continued a naive, confident attitude toward reason as it's guided by empirical methods. Now, depending on where you're coming from, what I've just said is either a great insult or it's a great compliment. The people who were secularists of the 19th century, if I point out, it's like, had you been listening? You haven't answered Kant. You've got a big problem on your hands. They say, there's no problem. You know, that's a great compliment to us, that we haven't been sidetracked by these German, you know, nutcases like Kant. We have better things to do than that. But for where I'm coming from as a teacher of philosophy, and especially the history of philosophy, I think it's rather naive when Kant has done this devastating work to just kind of close your eyes and just continue with Enlightenment confidence and reason. Nevertheless, these secular developments shared Kant's negative attitude toward metaphysics. They didn't share his negative attitude toward science and reason or empirical reasoning, but they did share his negative attitude toward knowing reality in itself, ultimate reality, metaphysics. But they were more anti-metaphysical than Kant. Make sure you note that. They shared his negative attitude, but they upped the ante quite a bit. Because you may remember, Kant said, we can't know anything about it, but there is a thing in itself. There is a noumenal realm. The secularist that I'm speaking of rejected things in themselves altogether. They were phenomenalists. That's why I used that term earlier. They were phenomenalists. Everything that we know is phenomena. There is no noumena. Kant said there is a noumena. We don't know anything more about it than that. These people said, just drop it altogether. There is no noumena. They were anti-metaphysical with a vengeance. And so their attention shifts. Well, wait, before I say that, I want to note that they were not just going beyond Kant in saying that there is no metaphysics, no noumena. Quite contrary to Hegel as well, they were indifferent and sometimes hostile to the idea of systems. The one thing you have to give Hegel credit for is he had a grand idea of a system of thought. Everything would fit into his system one way or another. All the accumulation of knowledge of the ages and all logic and so forth. Well, these secularists were quite indifferent, in many cases disrespectful to the idea of system. They derogated notions of theory as being speculative. They derogated the the drive for coherence, where everything is brought together and integrated. They were more in favor of the positive data of empirical experience. I want you, even though we haven't talked about positivism yet, I want you to have a feel for this, that instead of systems and theories that bring everything together, what's important is just the positive data. All ideas, to the secularist that we're going to talk about, all ideas tend to be an ideology that you should suspect. And ideas should not be evaluated as to whether they are ultimately true, ultimately false. In the end, they should be interpreted and evaluated as to their consequences. Who does that sound like? Who did we just study? Nietzsche. Nietzsche came to this through a different, you know, window, to be sure. But Nietzsche ends up saying, what's important is not truth and error, but consequences. Whether a statement is instrumental to accomplish your ends. Well, they were not nihilists in the full-blown Nietzsche sense. I mean, he had a boldness to go all the way with this. But they did believe that, if you will, metaphysical truth is not what's important. Don't worry about theories. Don't worry about systems of thought. You worry about positive data and the consequences of the positive data. And that will lead to, we're going to talk about this in the 20th century division, that will lead to pragmatism ultimately. So, five implications of this secular mentality that I've been trying to generalize and describe for you. First of all, the secularists that we're going to be looking at shift their attention from a static view of the universe to a view of the universe that is developing through time. The 19th century secular outlook puts a great emphasis on the historical perspective, the developmental genetic perspective, where things come from, how they've developed, because everything is developing. The universe is not just static objects and eternal truths, after all. Secondly, in my generalization about 19th century secularism, you'll see that life and ethics must become practically oriented. Practically oriented. Not only historically oriented, but practically. What is valuable is not motives, like Kant said, the purity of a man's will. What's valuable are consequences. And so, for instance, the utilitarians don't want to talk about abstract rights. They want to talk about what actually brings social reform, what makes people happy. It's the outcome that counts, not the theory that leads to it. Thirdly, the secularists shift away from traditional questions in metaphysics and epistemology. As I've just said, they were anti-system, they were anti-theory, and their shift is to social philosophy. In particular, a shift to a scientific treatment of nature and society. The reason why I'm calling this secularism is because it emphasizes the here and now studied apart from revelation, apart from religion, and apart from all speculation. Systems of philosophy are derogated as ideologies. The new secular man is going to address his environment and himself in a scientific way. By the way, just as an aside, to give you some feedback, as I'm watching you taking notes and so forth, you understand this without any problem. You're not having any difficulty with this, because this is the zeitgeist, this is the spirit of the age in which you have grown up. You don't agree with it, but you're not having any, I mean, there's no Hegelian nonsense in this. Yeah, that's right. That's what we're dealing with. Isn't that amazing? It shows, you know, where we come from. And also shows that when I gave you my promise, I wasn't lying, that after Hegel, it all gets easier. Well, back to my notes. First, a shift from the static view of the universe to a developing view, historical perspective. Secondly, a practical perspective that looks at consequences, not motives and theories and so forth. Third, a shift away from the traditional philosophical questions of metaphysics and theory of knowledge, and a shift towards social philosophy. And so we have a great deal of 19th century interest in reform, or in the case of Marx, revolution. Reform and revolution become primary philosophical of primary philosophical interest to these secularists. The new secular man is going to address his environment. He's going to look at nature and society and himself apart from revelation, apart from religion, apart from philosophical speculation. He's going to be scientific. Here's the secular man. Fourthly, 19th century secularism is characterized by what might be called scientism, the view that there are settled laws that can simply answer all philosophical problems. If we would just empirically study our environment, we would find those iron laws of reality, and in terms of them, all philosophical problems can be answered. The secularist optimistically thought they could apply empirical methods to solve the grave social problems of man. That in fact there is unlimited progress possible for man through the power of his knowing, through the power of knowledge. You all understand that, right? I'm getting ahead of myself, but think about American education. Why is American education the great messiah for us? Because if we would just apply the power of knowing, be empirical, down to earth, we'd be able to solve our social problems. Illegitimacy and drugs and war and poverty would go away. Like I say, how's it going? How's it working out here in this optimistic secular approach to solving things? If we could just empirically get to the laws of science, then we'd be able to solve our problems. Yeah, right. Number five, the emphasis in 19th century secularism is that man is part of nature. Man is no longer the image of God, closer to the angels, if you will. Man is no longer even philosophically special because he's the reasoning animal. But man is simply a natural object. He's part of nature. His body, his activities, and even his mind can be scientifically studied. We use the genetic model. Where did man's thinking come from genetically? Where does his behavior come from genetically? And so man is now seen as part of nature. And what this leads to is three things: evolution, psychology, and sociology in the 19th century. Evolutionary view of man, the development of psychological study of man, and the alleged science of sociology. All right, so these remarks have been intended to introduce the third major stream of 19th century philosophy. We have non-cognitivism over on one side here as a response to Hume and Kant, rationalism, another response to Kant and Hume, and now secularism with its scientific and its sociological orientation. If you look at your lecture outline, you know that what's coming now, the next school of thought that we're going to look at, is called British Utilitarianism. The British utilitarians naively accepted an empirical approach to knowledge and what's called psychological associationism. the way in which the mind of man works is by means of association of ideas affecting one another. They naively accepted empiricism and psychological associationism and felt that social theory should no longer be based on quote-unquote eternal verities. The language of eternal verities is Locke's. And who do you know, what culture or nation, inherited Locke's notion of eternal verities? The United States of America, of course. We enshrined that in the Declaration of Independence. There are what? Inalienable rights that nature and nature's God. Now that's Lockean in its outlook. The utilitarians, now what have I already said? Are suspicious of what? System theory, abstract notions. The utilitarians say social theory shouldn't be based on Locke's eternal verities or anybody else's eternal verities. Shouldn't be based on eternal verities, but only the principle, only those principles that can be proved empirically. Social theory needs to be guided by principles that are empirically provable. Okay, and we're going to look at two utilitarians. First, Jeremy Bentham, and then John Stuart Mill.